You're listening to KKCR, Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea, K284AL, Haleiwa. It's time for In the Garden on the Farm.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of KKCR, its board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters.
Aloha and welcome to In the Garden on the Farm, your weekly radio program that cultivates the passion and knowledge to grow well with plants and animals. We're your hosts, Paul and Robin, and on today's show, we invite you to join us in exploring the seen and unseen details of the living world as we look at plant structure and function, harvest orange orbs of the season, open your communication with nature spirits. Aloha and welcome, everyone.
Aloha.
How you doing, Robin?
Wonderful. It's wonderful to be here.
What a beautiful song from our friend Eroshin to open the show. Thank you so much for the beautiful music. And we are back in the house to just explore our love affair with plants and nature here on this beautiful island of Kauai.
Indeed we are, and like we always like to start by thanking our lucky stars and other heavenly bodies at the Celestial Session.
Indeed, and thanks went out to a beautiful waning crescent moon this morning at sunrise. And this moon in the Hawaiian tradition, we are informed by the Hui Maui Ola calendar as Lono, and Lono rose over Kauai at 3:08 a.m. this morning. She reaches her transit, or the top of her journey across the heavenly sky, at 9:21 a.m. She did, I should say. And she'll set at 3:30 p.m. this afternoon. 15% of the moon's face is illuminated. And new moon is coming up this Sunday at 2:51 a.m. We may hear something from Robin, I'm not sure, about a hybrid total and annular solar eclipse that's coming up. Unfortunately, we won't be seeing it here in Hawaii, but it is occurring also on Sunday. And so it's a combination of the moon's face, or rather to say the sun's face, being completely obscured or covered by the moon. But then in another part of the occurrence, there's a ring around the sun, and that depends on the distance of the moon changing from the Earth during the eclipse, is what
wow.
I understand, which is pretty cool. So Lono, our moon for today, Lono, sacred to the god Lono, known good for planting ipu, which are gourds, and melons, which may not be the right time of year in this part of the island, but for people living on the west side, the sunnier side, it could be beneficial with fewer fruit flies, perhaps, after the mangoes and the guavas have gone from the scene. It might be just the right time for that kind of thing. Lono, the god associated with fertility, agriculture, rainfall, music, and peace. So I think for the planter, we couldn't be happier than to see a moon that is dedicated to all those beautiful things and traditions that we carry forward here in Hawaii.
Incredible. Well, according to Maria Thun's biodynamic calendar, today until 2 p.m., the moon's in Leo, making it a fire sign, so it's good for fruit planting, dealing with fruit plants, handling them, picking them, that kind of thing. And then the moon will move into Virgo until Friday, an earth sign, also one of the largest of the constellations astronomically. So we get a good long run in Virgo, really paying attention to our root crops. Saturday, for whatever it's worth here, daylight savings time doesn't really affect us in Hawaii. However, when we need to call people on the mainland, it really does affect us.
When we're ordering seeds and we want to talk to the person, yeah.
On the East Coast particularly, you have to kind of time it out. So that will change. Although Saturday is considered an unproductive planting time, up until 10 a.m. Sunday morning when the moon will move into Libra, an air sign, making it a great time for flower planting. According to this calendar, I only could glean that the new moon was around 1 a.m., but I see it's actually at 2:15 a.m. on Monday morning or late Sunday night. And on Monday and Tuesday, the moon will move into Scorpio, a water sign, making it good for our leaf plants. We will be reaching the end of the northern transplanting time right around next Tuesday. So get your plants in the ground now, because once Wednesday rolls around and the moon reaches its perigee, we will be back to wanting to work with the upper parts of the plant again, pruning, taking cuttings and things like that, harvesting fruit. And just while we're at it, on this fine day before Halloween, one of my personal favorite times of year, for lots of different reasons, I just want to give a little hat tip to Maria Thun. I've used her calendar for years. Her years of research into lunar planting times is just inexhaustible. And then when she got into the outer planets' effects on plants, there's just an incredible amount of research and record keeping, which she actually farmed at multiple locations in Europe, mostly Germany, when she was doing her work. The North American Biodynamic Sowing and Planting Calendar for 2014 is now available out there. I already got mine, geeked out a little bit. And it's actually, the calendar itself is just an amazing primer in dedication to Maria Thun's work. It's just incredible.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
Absolutely. Well, that big golden orb called the sun is not the only golden orb out there.
And we're starting to see them on people's porches and certainly in the supermarket and hopefully lucky enough in the field. If you
sure.
happen to be living close enough where the fruit of the season, the pumpkin,
yes.
is making its appearance and its fruition.
Absolutely. And, you know, I did a little bit of research and I found out that in Hawaii, the state of Hawaii, there is at least one pick your own pumpkin farm. It sounds pretty fun if you want to pack the kids up on the airplane and head on over to the Big Island at Kohala Mountain Farm, which is between Waimea and Hawi on Kohala Mountain Road. They actually have a pick your own pumpkin. They do haunted house, the whole nine yards. But what was really interesting is that they have offered last year and this year a corn maze design contest. And in the design contest of last year, the winning corn maze was just outrageous. I mean, it was right up there with crop circles right here in Hawaii. And these corn mazes were actually designed by children at elementary schools. Pretty awesome. I imagine they had some adult help pulling it off, but the designs themselves, it's just pretty cool. You can actually check it out on their website, Kohala Mountain Farm. On Kauai, we mostly have locally grown kabochas. They're large and beautiful, and they really are best for eating. When you carve a pumpkin, so much of it goes uneaten, and we don't like to see waste. So really the sort of cheaper grocery store versions are better if you just want to carve out a jack-o'-lantern, although all of them look beautiful. But our local kabochas cannot be beaten for either pies or roasting or soup or whatever it is you like to do with fresh pumpkin.
I have to make a public sort of admission is I've been telling people for years now that kabocha was a moshata, and it turns out that it's a maxima. So I don't know how much of that's actually being grown on Kauai and whether or not how much of the misunderstanding has been propagated from me just repeating that.
So you're talking about the species name, just to clarify for our listeners.
Correct.
Curcubita moshata. So the local kabochas that we have here, you're saying, are Curcubita maxima. Is that correct? Did I understand you right?
I'm saying that the pumpkins that we have been calling kabocha perhaps are not because they... But, yeah, the confusion continues. However, the other characteristics of the species of moshata seem to be consistent with these local pumpkins we've been calling kabocha, in terms of the quality of the leaf, especially. So I'm not quite sure, but just know that the maxima is also the jack-o'-lantern, is it not?
I believe that it is.
Yeah, so yeah. Cucurbita maxima is the jack-o'-lantern, and so that's the same as kabocha.
Wow, interesting. Well, I say no matter what you call it, they're delicious, right?
Indeed.
We call them good. Let's see, how to pick out a pumpkin if you're going to be buying one to eat. With the jack-o'-lantern, you're mostly looking at shape, you know, for the most part. Although you could use these guidelines as well for picking any kind of pumpkin. Visual appeal is really important. The color, the shape. Make sure that it's free of cuts, soft spots, or bruises, as pumpkins can rot easily. And make sure it has a stem intact. That also helps it from not going bad too quickly. That is a very important pico spot on the fruit. And when that stem is removed, it does change everything in the storage capacity of that pumpkin. Right. Along those lines, we want to handle our pumpkins with care. Sometimes you can cure them you can actually store them for quite a while if they have no soft spots or bruises and the stem is intact. And what happens during curing is that the rind kind of toughens up and it actually protects the rest of the pumpkin from rotting. So often I've heard growers say that the longer the pumpkin sits, the more sweet it gets, which is not the case with all fresh produce.
Right.
So pumpkins do make a nice storage option. And I sure hope that people who have them planted in their gardens are starting to harvest theirs right now. Really quickly, it's a low-calorie, a storehouse of antioxidants. It's a great source of B vitamins. When it's grown in good soil, has lots of minerals like copper, calcium, potassium, and phosphorus. And the seeds themselves are very high in iron and zinc, so they're very good for roasting and eating as well. So good luck. I hope you find some nice ones out there this week.
Indeed. And if you're lucky enough to have a field of pumpkins of whatever species or shape that you may have, it just made me think when you talked about you really want to keep that stem on, the importance of not lifting the pumpkin by the stem, because it can be quite a brittle and easy to detach sort of connection. And then if you do break one, which seems almost inevitable if you're going out and collecting 20, 30 pumpkins, it seems that at least one or two would be broken. Use those right away.
Yes.
And enjoy them right away. And then as far as the seeds go, do you have any particular preference?
For eating
them.
You know, I basically...
Well, replanting them would be the first preference.
Exactly. I was going to say, at least, you know, depending on how high quality I thought the pumpkin was when I ate it, at least 25% of them are going to find their way into my little seed bank.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest of them, I personally like to toss them with a little bit of salt and ground chili pepper and roast them a little bit on a cookie sheet. Very delicious snack.
Next week, I hope.
Yes.
I'll be here. So today we've been excited about this show, and I think I'll let Robin mention, because I think her excitement has bubbled it over even more than my own for the preparation for this show. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'll say that we invite you to acknowledge that which is beyond the material plane today on the show, and it has to do with the garden here. As October 31st approaches, a holiday known in ancient Druid times as Samhain, the veils between worlds become more transparent. And with a little practice, we can learn how to communicate beyond our own species.
Mm-hmm.
So I invite you today to tune in to what we see without our eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And enter the realm of esoteria.
And esoteria, or esoteric, according to my Apple dictionary, is an adjective intended, the definition being intended for or likely to be understood by only a small number of people with a specialized knowledge or interest. Now, some may argue that our show is always kind of esoteric because we really delve into our interest in plants and all of the different ways in which these interactions, both seen and unseen, understood and not understood, are taking a role and potentially a toll in the success of our efforts as gardeners and farmers. So I accept your invitation, Robin, and I'm going to start from a place where we do use our traditional sense of sight and observation and maybe meld into and travel through into maybe some of those unseen places. So certainly an esoteric subject in relation to plants would be plant morphology.
Hmm.
Yeah. And plant morphology is essentially the study of the external structures of the plants. While that may seem shallow,
mundane,
it's only on the surface, there's so much that can be learned, and it's really a doorway into understanding not only the structures themselves and their uses, but the interrelationships of environment. The practice of morphology was recorded as far back as 300 BC in Greece. And while it's a science to many learned people, if you can distinguish between a flower, a fruit, or a tendril of a plant, you are familiar with morphology. It's something we all do to one extent or another. And I think that sometimes the more people are trained into what they're supposed to be seeing, the less intuitive or insightful that their observations may become. And the best of scientists keep that open, expansive questioning in mind, even if they're applying all of the textbook rules and that kind of thing. Morphology study at its best reveals the inherent intelligent design of nature, showing creative adaptation to the environment. And in relation to that, I wanted to discuss a couple of different morphological tendencies of plants under certain environmental character and environmental situations, and they're both in relation to root structures.
Ooh.
Yeah, and I want to give thanks to the authors of this beautiful book that I've only begun to crack after having it on the shelf for a few years. It's called Plant Form, An Illustrated Guide to Flowering Plant Morphology by Adrian Bell. Illustrations by Alan Bryan, just a gorgeous, I think, British publication. And in its second edition now, many beautiful line drawings of the very specific structures, as well as a full description, discussion about how they came to be and what they do. And so the couple of things that I'm wanting to share with you today are, I'll start off with Haustoria. And Haustoria are structures, I'll just go ahead and read this beginning description for you. Parasitic and hemiparasitic flowering plants obtain the whole or part of their food by the intrusion of Haustoria into the host's tissue. Sort of seems good for a Halloween treat. The morphology of Haustoria vary considerably and often cannot be recognized externally or internally as a root modification, although they may develop from existing roots or from stems. In Cuscuta, which is a genus that we have here in Hawaii, it's the Kaunaoa. It's actually the true Kaunaoa. We have a couple of different kinds of Kaunaoa, but this is the endemic Kaunaoa.
Kaunaoa is that viney plant that has no leaves that grows all over scrub, kind of out in the Polihale district and other places, correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
And in Polihale, you're perhaps more likely to see the endemic Cuscuta, as opposed to the indigenous Kasitha, which is the one that we see growing along the Nepali coast. I actually meant to bring some. There's some growing right at the beach in Anahola, and both of them medicinal in nature. So in relation to the Haustoria of that daughter.
Sure. So this is how this plant actually lives off another plant.
It's kind of like a vampire, really.
Yeah. Yeah. Ooh, tell us.
Okay. In Cuscuta, secretory trichomes cement the parasite to the host. And then parasite cells form a chimera with the host cell walls. So what essentially is, it mimics, and that's how you can't really tell where does one plant begin and another one end.
Huh.
Other parasitic plants form root outgrowths that attach to the surface of the host, and tissue connection develops internally by the formation of Haustoria. A bizarre Haustorium is produced in the hemiparasitic tree, Nustia. It develops from small lateral roots and grows around a host root. The Haustorium contain a sharp-edged sclerochetamus cutting device.
Ooh.
I know I didn't say that right, but it sounded good. The two arms of which force together to sever the host root.
Oh, my.
Yes.
Vicious.
Totally.
That's
vicious.
Rather vicious.
So we have, again, native plants that have this need to suck their energies off of their host plants, the Kaunooa being some, and then perhaps more familiar to some of our listeners is the Iliahi, or the sandalwood. And I was fortunate enough to speak briefly with Mike DeMota, who's the Assistant Director of Living Collections and Horticulture at the National Tropical Botanical Garden, who has a lot of experience about establishing native plants in new locations, doing plant restoration, or even just getting plants going in a managed garden. And sandalwood is a very difficult one because if it doesn't develop that parasitic relationship within a certain amount of time, a very healthy seedling will just decline quickly and die. And so the intent of my call to him was, what are the best plants to use and what is the method? And his suggestion is that it's really a numbers game. It's quite difficult to get the sandalwood to develop this parasitic relationship. And so the best thing to do is plant a whole bunch, and maybe out of, 25, you'll just get one that will make it. That being said, there are a wide variety of different plants that provide a good parasitic host relationship with the sandalwood. Grasses are quite effective, and pretty much any kind of legume that might be appropriate for that site. So many different, anything from a koa tree to a willy willy, many other kinds, mamane, many other kinds of native as well as non-native leguminous plants will be effective as well, a'ali'i. And then a technique that people sometimes use is when they plant, if they're planting in pots, they'll put the sandalwood and they'll put the host plant in the same pot. In Mike's experience, however, the situation is that the host plant will very quickly overgrow and overwhelm the sandalwood, and that it's oftentimes more effective to plant them out in the ground at somewhat of a close spacing depending on the size of the plant. Of course, if you're planting it with grass, you're going to plant it closer than you would if it was a koa tree. And then you just really have to monitor that relationship. It was my misunderstanding that it was only for a certain period of time that the sandalwood required that relationship, and that eventually, once it became mature, that it would be able to survive without the host. However, Mike tells me that even with a mature sandalwood tree, if you take out the host, eventually the sandalwood can die as well.
Mm. So it's a lifelong connection they have. They're married.
Indeed. Now, is anything going on with, is there anything, any benefit to the host plant? I suppose if there was, it wouldn't be called a parasitic relationship. So at any rate, nature has many ways of getting its needs met, and that's a particularly ghoulish way, I suppose, is through the sucking the life force, at least some of the life force, out of its neighbors. The second morphological habit of plants, and this is maybe even more specialized, would be in the case of pneumatophores. Pneumatophores, yes. These are breathing roots.
Mm.
And these breathing roots occur on plants that tend to live in a swampy or, in some cases, tidal environment, and a classic example would be mangroves.
Mm.
So when plants in general receive oxygen from their roots. However, when their roots are in a oxygen-deprived soil or media, they have to find out other ways to do it. In the case of taro, the roots have modified themselves so that they can receive oxygen from low oxygen environment situations as well as through the upper part of their plant. And then other plants have actually shot up structures from their roots into the atmosphere.
Hmm.
And so that would be an example of this. And so the definition, pneumatophora, specialized root that grows upwards out of the water or mud to reach the air and obtain oxygen for the root systems of trees that live in swampy or tidal habitats. They use lenticels, which are found on many plants, and I was happy to learn that they are pores that allow for gaseous exchange from the outward environment to the inside the stem. Often the bark of a tree does not allow for its pretty much a barrier. And so these lenticels, of which you see many on so many different kinds of plants and are often used to identify plants, is actually those pores that allow for gaseous exchange from a woody plant. And pneumatophores can also mean the gas-filled sac on certain kinds of creatures like a Portuguese man-of-war that cause them to float.
Ah, or like the water hyacinths that like to grow in the streams.
Exactly.
Yeah, far
exactly
out.
That.
Far out. You know, I've been noticing in Kapa'a, could it be that I'm seeing mangroves growing up that little stream that's next to Hemingway Cafe? Have you ever gazed
Indeed.
Up there?
I've seen quite a lot of mangrove growing in the Kapa'a, yes.
Cool.
Areas where the agricultural ditches have been sitting dormant and unmaintained for many decades.
Sure, now they're fish nurseries, probably. So, I noticed that same stream is where a lot of people tend to fish.
Oh, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
I hope that, is it catch and release, or are they taking them home?
Mm-hmm.
So to provide a bridge from this observation that we do see with our eyes, and to explore that possibility that the morphology of plants can touch more of our senses, I'm going to read a short passage from The Secret Teachings of Plants in the Direct Perception of Nature, a beautiful book by Stephen Herod Bunner. And this is in relation to a collection expedition for swamp cabbage. So he's already done the laborious process of digging this huge plant out of the muck and connecting with all of his senses in the environment in which he finds himself. The root is huge, and the rootlets like Medusa's hair, a swirling, moving set of tendrils wriggling out from the bottom of the plant. It almost seems as if they are the plant. The whole of your attention focuses upon them. You almost want to turn the plant upside down, as if the roots are the head and the leaves the root. So eventually you do. You feel yourself then looking at some ancient being, find yourself in some ancient story whose telling began long ago. The roots are thick, segmented, and a mucousy white, yellow-tinged on the surface, ancient and filled with a living force, a life rooted deep, as if the rootlets had reached farther, far deeper than their length. As if they had pulled some ancient power from deeper in the earth than humans have ever gone. As if mountains, immeasurably old, had grown under the soil. As if their power had found their way into these rootlets, into this plant.
Mm.
So, again, the doorways of perception can be opened by a beginning relationship that can expand into a much deeper understanding of what is present now in this moment is what can be found in the past, in the future perhaps.
Indeed, and we talk all the time on the show here about refining our skills of observation. And today we ask you, just take it a step further, you know, get out there. I know I've read that very book, and when he describes walking through the swamp and the thick mud, and, you know, really asks us to just understand where we are, really dig deep and be present into what we're experiencing in our garden. I mean, there's so many magical things that we can see out there, like I said, without our eyes, that we can feel a knowing. You know, when you've made friends with plants, especially the long-term and perennial plants in our gardens, you know, they just really speak to us if we're there to listen. And it just takes a little practice, really, to understand how to read them and understand their language.
Indeed. You're listening to KKCR, Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea. This is In the Garden on the Farm with your hosts Robin and Paul, and we are covering the esoteric relationship of humans and plants. And I wanted to mention that I was fortunate enough to participate in the workshop at Sun and Lisa's farm, One Song Farm, this past Sunday. And there was a choice of following along with Sun or Lisa, and this time around I followed Sun and was very happy I did. I look forward to following Lisa next time around. He made a question was, do you follow a planting calendar? And while he does pay attention to and is informed by the biodynamic calendar, he reminded us to consider that local variations exist. And while sometimes the calendar would say the leaf period has ended, he would tune in and he would get it's still happening. And so it's really about that personal relationship and opening those senses, being informed by what we can take maybe from an intellectual level, but never letting that trump our true and intuitive sense.
Absolutely.
So right now we are very blessed to be joined by a special guest. And all the way from Montana, we're being joined by Michael Pilarski. Michael Pilarski has called the Pacific Northwest home since 1970. During that time, he has been a prolific organizer, teacher, and writer, working in sustainable agriculture, permaculture, forestry, and herbal medicine. Michael, or Skeeter as we love to call him, has started and organized over 100 gatherings, including agriculture conferences, permaculture convergences, barter fairs, and herbal gatherings. As well as his work with the physical earth, Michael is a longtime student of esoteric realms and is the founder of the Fairy and Human Relations Congress held for the last 13 years. He's been to Kauai 4 times, during which he has taught 2 permaculture design courses, classes on agroforestry and medicinal plant cultivation, and organized a healing gathering. In his upcoming trip, he will be teaching a permaculture design course and helping organize 2 events, Kauai Gathering of the Realms and Kauai Singing Alive. Skeeter, it's great to have you on the show.
Yes, Paul. Nice to chat with you and be at least there in voice, and I look forward to seeing you in February.
That can't come soon enough, but it will be right around the corner.
Oh, yeah.
It's great to hear your voice, too. I've been listening to your YouTube videos for a couple days. Skeeter, can you tell me, do you have your radio on by any chance?
No.
No, okay. I thought I was hearing a little feedback. Okay.
So, as you may have overheard, we've been discussing the realms beyond and are opening our senses to the unseen forces at play in our gardens and farms. And certainly you have a lot of experience with that as a long-term farmer and somebody who's opened your own senses and helped others to do so.
Yeah, well, there's more and more people are doing that these days. And truth be told, I think that most people have some sense of working with nature, you know, just the act of looking out at a beautiful sunset or feeling a sense of peace in a forest, or, you know, the nature is always impacting us, and sometimes it gets through. Humans, a lot of humans are pretty good at blocking out the natural world, but a few of us escape at least some intimation that there's a, you know, a connection going on.
So can you tell us about, very interested to hear about the gatherings that you specifically hold there in the Pacific Northwest to encourage people's relationship with nature spirits?
Yeah, well, it's a long story, but to make a really short one, and in the 70s, I was introduced to a book called A True Fairy Tale by a woman named Daphne Charters. And once I read her book, I really started looking into fairies, actually became friends with the author, Daphne Charters, who lived in England. We never met in person, but she left me behind all her writings to publish, and so we've got one volume of 3 out so far. And as a result of working with her works, And then researching others, I became more and more involved in and conversant in the working with the fairy realm. And, of course, I was sort of a bumbling along in those days, as perhaps some people might say today. But over time, as I got more into this, I decided to put on a gathering called the Fairy and Human Relations Congress, which is held for 13 years now in Washington State. And we've very quickly built it up, not so much in numbers. We have around 300 people attend, 250 to 300. But in terms of quality and depth of communication. So it's always been our aim to bring the best people we can find in the world to our gathering. And we couldn't afford too many from overseas, but occasionally. But we bring people from around the United States. And so we've had some of the greats like Dorothy McLean, who put Findhorn on the map, and David Spangler, and R.J. Stewart, who's probably the foremost expert on Celtic fairy traditions today. And we had Peter Tompkins, who wrote The Secret Life of Plants. So we've had about 75 presenters over the years now. So we've brought all these people through the doors of our gathering that work with the fairy realms in some aspect or another, and listen to all of them. And so we're getting sort of this, in a sense, a composite picture of what the different fairy realms are like, because just as the, even more so than the human realms, they're really vast. I mean, there's so many human cultures. Well, there's differences there, too. They're not all, once you've seen one fairy, you haven't seen them all.
I believe you.
And so
yeah,
you,
Robin, is it nice to make your acquaintance, too?
Yes.
So do you have to give plenty of advance notice to the spirits that you're hoping will join you as well and make sure they're not booked already for your
Congress? No, many of them can actually multitask pretty well. They don't have to book expensive plane flights. They can just sort of, in the blink of an eye, show up. So, but it does help to give advance notice, yes. And so we do spend time in between gatherings making connections and, in fact, many of us have ongoing relationships with various fairy beings. And, of course, they are really into the Fairy Congress. I mean, there's 250 to 300 incarnate or physical humans there. But the numbers of fairies and other beings that show up is astronomical figures. So we've been told, I mean, you know, people that have the sight, assure us that there are many thousands of beings that come. And so they have it marked on their calendar, too. When we set the date, they all get notified.
Nice. So we're speaking with Michael Pilarski about fairy congresses, and we're fortunate enough that you're going to be bringing one here to our very island of Kauai in February. Is that right?
Yes, February 7th and 8th and 9th. Probably a little shoulder events either side. And yeah, before the interview here, or this little talk, I wrote down six reasons or six things that we're planning to do. Why are we getting together on Kauai to communicate with the fairies and devas and beings there? Well, it's partly so that the humans that are doing these things can learn from each other. And so we're hoping to attract people from around the islands. We'll imagine some people from the mainland, but mostly Kauai, some from other islands. And so we're looking for who in Hawaii now is pursuing this work, who is communicating with the nature, spirits, fairies, devas, under whatever names you want to give. And, of course, the Hawaiians had great communication with the spirits of the sea and the land, the air, the fires, etc. So they have always had a strong connection. In fact, every indigenous culture has always had a strong connection to the spirits of the land. So we're bringing together people who are doing that today from whatever tradition or new aspect that is being created, to share information with each other, learn from each other. How do we do it? So, for instance, I will lead a particular ceremony or where we actually do communicate with the other realms, and other people can also do it in their own languages, in their own traditions, and we can all learn from just sort of how each other does these things. So it's partly about learning from each other, the humans, but it's partly to talk to the beings of the air, the land, the seas that are already on Kauai. And it's interesting, when I tuned in the other day to the, I went to the ferry crossroads I go to, and was able to connect with some of the devas from Kauai, and they told me that to consider that when we put this event on to talk to the plant, in a sense, the plants and the plant spirits of Kauai, that not only are we now communing with all the native Kauai native plant spirits and devas, you might think of that each species of plant has a particular guardian angel or a particular devic being, a great being, who, in a sense, informs and is in touch with all those species all over the world. And since Kauai now, with its botanical gardens and all these plantings over the years, there are thousands of species of plants and trees from all over the world on Kauai. And so they said, remember that when you have this gathering here to communicate with the spirits and devas of the Kauai plants, that you'll also be having as hosting or as part of the Congress these guardian angel devas from all the other species of plants that now exist on Kauai. So they'll be in the thousands right there. So that was pretty interesting to hear. So we are actually talking to the fairies, and one of the reasons we talked to them, just as the Hawaiians did in the old days, was to placate them, to implore them, to seek their aid, to look for good harvests, good rains, not for floods. And so we're asking for their help, and in exchange, we're also going to be sending them love and looking for ways that we can help them. So it's a two-way street. It isn't just them. We are both giving to each other, sharing with each other, co-creating with each other, helping each other. And we want to do this not only for us as individuals, but and for the island of Kauai, for its health and happiness, but also for the earth, because we, as a group of people working with nature, we can work with the earth for the good of all humanity. So in a sense, we have a small picture of what we do as individuals, but the big picture of this is that it's beyond Kauai. We're trying to bring this together to pray, in a sense, and to help the whole world. And people might say, well, why would some Hawaiians or some Shinto Japanese or some Buddhists or whoever come and share their traditions of communication at a gathering like this? And why would the fairies want to come and work with us? And I personally feel that the world is in a real crisis at this point. Humanity and the earth itself, things are bad and getting worse. And working, and we need to swim together or we might all sink together. And so by sharing our traditions and by working with these, all these other beings that live on the earth, we share the earth with them. We all have a common cause to save the earth and keep it in a good shape. Mm-hmm. We all have the same end goals, a good earth for all our future generations to live on. Well, whether you're Hawaiian or Japanese or Native American or Samoan or whoever you are, we all live on the earth. Let's put aside our differences. Let's put our heads together and let's try to get ourselves out of this crisis. And I think working with the spiritual realms is one of the tactics that we should be using.
Truly.
So that's why we're coming together.
And Kauai couldn't be a more ideal place for that, where the different cultural traditions that are represented are already so generous and blended and welcoming and wanting to collaborate and certainly saving the destiny of the planet for the plants, the people, and all the living beings and all the energies. Couldn't be a higher calling.
Yeah, so anyway, I think, and so of course, the with a good intent and a sacred, respectful attitude, I think the powers that be out there are going to be with us and supporting us.
Indeed. Tell me what you think. If there's a particular plant in my garden, a species or variety even, that is just calling to me, I'm really interested in it. I find myself, like so many gardeners, delving into trying to figure this plant out and just filled with that excitement of the relationship. What portion of that is because the Devic realm that oversees that plant is guiding me to have that excitement, and how much of it is simply the plant that I'm looking at?
I think it could be a mixture, and it's not always the same for everybody. Some people, it's just an intellectual interest, you know, based. Other ones, it's an intuitional or a heart-based thing, and it's we could look at it this way. If every human, or at least many humans, have spiritual guides and helpers and guardian angels, sometimes we have fairies that actually that are our friends on the other side, and they can actually, as you say, sometimes they can be calling us as well as we're calling them. And no matter what's going on, really, to deepen that relationship, just spend time with the plant. It's great to just hang out with it, meditate with it. If it's edible, to ingest it and care for it. The more I love so many plants. I have so many plant allies and friends, mm-hmm. and I just love plants.
Great. And, well, you know, Michael, can I ask you a question? Because I was reading through some stuff, doing some research, getting to know you a little bit via the internet, and couple things. One is I really appreciate your perspective on what people call weeds, and that's a mm-hmm. conversation right there. But I'm actually curious, what's one of your favorite exotics that you wish would grow where you live? I know you have so many allies, but there may be one or two of them out there that just have a hard time living in your climate.
Well, there's probably a lot of those too, but the first one that actually popped into my mind just when you asked that question was frangipani. Just the scent. I love when I get off an airplane in a subtropical or tropical environment, and the waft of the perfumed, warm, humid air, you know, just hits you when you walk out of the plane. And so, you know, the fragrant plants of the tropics and subtropics, you know, wish we could put it in a bottle and just send it to the house sometime. So I have to come back to Kauai for a little fix on that.
Yeah, awesome. So in terms of the nature spirits again, I'm wondering, for your personal relationship as a farmer, how has this relationship building that you've done made a difference for you in the way in which you have are led to success in your gardening and farming efforts?
Well, this year I had incredible gardens. First-year gardens, I started 5 new gardens this year in different locations, in different soils, and some of them not so good, some pretty good. And I had very good results. And so you might say, well, he's just a green thumb. He put the right fertilizers on and something. But I think that part of the reason for my successful gardening and plantings is that relationship I have on a spiritual basis with the plants. And I also find that because I respect them and love them, that I treat them really well. I'm very doting. I dote on my plants, and I really take care of them. And as a result of that, that respectful, loving attitude, it makes me really give them what they need so they can be really successful. So I think both of those, there's something esoteric in there, but there's also just the fact that loving what you do and really loving the plants leads you to do a good job.
Mm-hmm. Are you directed at any times by the deva of broccoli that you should be doing a particular thing that wouldn't have occurred to you otherwise?
Not in a conscious sense. Some people, the Paralandra books, for instance, outline how to communicate with the garden divas and say, where should I plant the carrots? Do they want more manure? Should I put the potatoes next to the horseradish, et cetera? And how to get answers, even if you don't hear. You know, it's just a matter of a little bit, sort of a dowsing or kinesiology, you might say. But I guess I wouldn't say that I do that. I do get messages. And I'm a real good gardener. I've been gardening for 40-plus years, so most of it's pretty automatic, I would say. But I do get hunches sometimes, and I would say where it comes up much more for me is when I'm out in the wild crafting medicinal plants, because that's one of my main income sources is wild crafting medicinal herbs. So I'm all the time out in the woods and the prairies and the sagebrush steppe gathering things. And oftentimes when I'm out there, I'll get distinct messages like, no, don't pick here, or that's enough, or here's the volunteers are over here. So there's a real sense of listening to what's appropriate and giving offering before I collect. And so I think I approach the wild plants, I guess you might say, with more... I'm looking for that communication maybe a bit more than I am in the garden, where I feel like I'm in charge. So it's interesting. I guess it's partly because nature's wild and I'm just a visitor, whereas in the garden I'm kind of like a god in the plants. I don't know if I can say maybe the plants worship me, but the plants and the fairies are very happy to see me. When I walk into my garden, everybody lights up.
As we will be when you grace our shores again and join us here on Kauai this coming year to share... The gathering of the realms, the fairy congress, whatever you might call it, deepening in our relationship with nature spirits, as well as acting as one of the primary instructors in a 2-week permaculture design course, mm-hmm. which was the context I was fortunate enough to meet you in 2009. Glad to know you'll be coming back to share that knowledge as well.
Mm-hmm. Do I have a minute to talk about singing, the Kauai Singing Alive?
Just about a minute.
Okay, so it's a gathering for people that like to do circle songs, since there'll be music and singing, a lot of sharing of singing, and usually sacred spiritual singing, you might say, from many cultures. And we've been doing it here on the mainland for 6 years, so it's just starting to branch out to other places. So anybody that loves to sing circle songs will want to come to our Kauai Singing Alive, too.
Can you tell our listeners, Michael, how people can get a hold of you if they'd like more information about this kind of thing? What's the best way to reach you?
Oh, the best way is by email.
Okay. And your email is?
friendsofthetrees@yahoo.com.
Friends of the trees.
Yes, friendsofthetrees@yahoo.com. And
any friend of the trees is a friend of mine.
Yeah. Yes. And I have a lot of friends. There's a lot of trees out there. So, I'm very much looking forward to being in Kauai, hanging out with the plants, going to the botanical gardens, being on the beaches, and just soaking up the mana of the place. So I look forward to seeing a lot of old friends and making some new ones. If anybody's interested in coming to this event or speaking or participating, I'd love to hear from you.
Great. And know that we will... let people know when there's more information to share about this, all the events that you'll be offering us. People will know right here on KKCR Kauai Community Radio. Michael, thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to having a chat with you on the show sometime coming up.
Yeah, thanks, Paul and Robin, and all you listeners.
Thank you much.
Aloha.
All right, aloha.
This has been In the Garden on the Farm with your hosts, Paul and Robin. We'd like to thank our guests on the show today, Michael Pilarski. Thank you so much, Michael. You can reach him at friendsofthetrees@yahoo.com for more information about his projects. Please tune in again next week for more stimulating conversation on our relationship with the life of the land that gives us life.